On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1783, the year George Washington resigned his commission as commander-in-chief and returned to Mount Vernon, Simon Bolivar was born to an aristocratic family in Caracas, Venezuela. He would live to be the great liberator of Spanish America, the Southern Hemisphere's George Washington, and maybe more. Not one nation, but six freed from colonial empire, from the Caribbean to South America's southern tip. Bolivar was a revolutionary hero who died in exile. He embodied a continent's struggle with race and class and democracy. He's embraced as a hero and anti-U.S. symbol today by Venezuela's populist leader, Hugo Chavez. Up next on Point, Simon Bolivar. We will talk in a moment with historian John Lynch. He's written the first major English-language biography of Bolivar to come out in 50 years. But we go first to Bolivar's birthplace, Caracas, Venezuela, where populist leader and frequent critic of the United States, Hugo Chavez, has revived Bolivar as a political cult figure. Andrew Webb Vidal is Venezuela and Colombia correspondent for the Financial Times. He joins me from Caracas. Andrew, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
We're well. First, let's just catch up with Hugo Chavez. He's just back from a world tour. Remind us where he's been and what he's done on that tour.
Well, Chavez travels a lot nowadays. He's spent about roughly a year abroad of his 7 years in government, and he's just come back from a 2 to 3 week tour in mostly in Asia, Russia, Belarus, Vietnam, Iran, and Mali in Africa as well.
It sounds like kind of top of the anti-Washington world tour, $1 billion arms purchase announced in Russia, very inflammatory comments about the United States in Tehran, Iran. He was there in Vietnam, which he calls North Vietnam. He's running rich with oil money and thumbing his nose all over the world at the USA, if I've got it right.
That's absolutely correct. Yes, there's plenty of money flowing into the Venezuelan government's coffers nowadays. Obviously, oil price has been exceptionally high in the last 3 years. And that money Chavez is using to buy arms and finance social programs inside Venezuela and all sorts of aid programs elsewhere in Latin America, too.
Venezuela under Chavez now also helping prop up the government in Cuba. What's the heart of his critique of the United States?
Well, he basically argues that the United States is an imperialist country. The current government, the Bush administration, is no exception to that. And he argues that Washington has dominated Latin America since colonial times. And that's the root of his Bolivarianism as well, very much an attitude towards negative and critical attitude towards Washington.
And speak to us about Bolivar and the place that he holds in Hugo Chavez's, the Venezuelan president's, view of the world. What does he draw on in the Bolivar legacy as he interprets it?
Well, Bolivarianism is a somewhat vague concept. Obviously, it's essentially a cult personality, or personality cult, rather. And perhaps one of the most sort of important elements of Simon Bolivar's original policies and goals is regional integration. Chavez sees that as one of his policy goals today, and that explains, you know, his efforts to integrate Latin America, but along his own particular model, which is a very militaristic model with a strong central government.
And is he looking to rally South America around the Bolivar flag? Are people responding to that?
He is trying to rally Latin America in that sense. But we must remember, Bolivar is much more of a sort of cultural hero in Venezuela and significantly less so in other countries in the region. I mean, he's very, very poorly known in places like Brazil, Argentina, Peru. Obviously, he's a bit more known in places such as Ecuador, Colombia, and Bolivia.
And the Bolivar flag, do the Venezuelan people respond to it, or is this Hugo Chavez sort of personal cult worship?
Yes, people do respond to Bolivarianism in Venezuela. And in that sense, Chavez has tried to infuse that sort of personality cult towards himself. I mean, he does try to portray himself almost as a reincarnation 200 years later of Simon Bolivar.
And U.S. response to Hugo Chavez, it's been very hot sometimes. How's it been recently? The Washington has a lot on its plate. Are they still throwing jibes his way?
Yes, more recently, the sort of attitude from Washington towards Chavez has been to sort of almost, not exactly leave him alone, but avoid making comments that would provoke him. Because one of Chavez's, certainly, abilities is to exploit comments made by officials in the U.S. As an attack on him, and thus he's able to respond in a sort of inflammatory way, and that gets him points with some people in this part of the world.
But for now, in power, living large on oil money, and lots of statues of Simón Bolívar around?
There's always been lots of statues of Simón Bolívar in Venezuela. Almost every village has a town square that's known as Plaza Bolívar, so no real change there.
Andrew Webb-Vidal in Caracas, correspondent for the Financial Times. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Joining me now from London is John Lynch. He's Emeritus Professor of Latin American History and former Director of the Institute of Latin American Studies at the University of London. His much-celebrated new biography of Simón Bolívar is titled Simón Bolívar, A Life. John Lynch, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
You have laid out in wonderful perspective and detail the life of this giant in South America, the details of which are sometimes astonishingly little known by most North Americans, or at least United States citizens. Paint a kind of opening picture of Simón Bolívar for us, if you would, the scale of his impact on this hemisphere.
The title preferred by Bolívar was not president or general, much less dictator, but, as you've noted, liberator. He was the leader of a national liberation movement, one of the first national liberation movements in the modern world, and he provided not only the military know-how to evict the Spaniards from South America, but also the intellectual basis justifying the destruction of an empire and the creation of new nations. Having defeated the Spaniards and driven them out of South America, he then faced the task of state building. Here, he was more controversial, and many of his proposals for the new states did not come to fruition, or the fruition that he desired. And that's where the argument begins about Bolívar.
A liberator, you write, who was not liberal. What do you mean?
He was a Democrat in some senses. And he was a liberal, too, in the sense that he'd imbibed the thought of the Enlightenment. He was a follower of Rousseau. And he believed in liberty. Those were the two things he stood for, equality and liberty. But he thought that undiluted liberty to peoples who were just emerging from colonial conditions was dangerous. And he thought that he had to guide Latin America between the oppression of colonialism and the anarchy of undiluted liberalism, as he saw it.
So the
liberalism of Bolívar was a liberalism tempered by South American conditions of extreme regionalism, racial heterogeneity, and a post-war depression. And in these circumstances, he has been accused of being authoritarian rather than liberal.
The war he led was long. It spanned an enormous continent, much, much longer than the American Revolution. Describe just the basic dimensions of that war of liberation that he pursued across the Southern Hemisphere.
Well, to many of his contemporaries, his strategy for the war seemed crazy. But looking at it now, it was inevitable. In the first place, he was defeated in Venezuela itself. And the first campaigns in Venezuela led eventually to his temporary exile and a need to refocus his strategy. He gradually found out that to defeat the Spaniards, it's no use fighting them in the northern coast of South America, where they were strong and embedded, that he had to strike into the interior. And so from the interior of Venezuela, based on Angostura, he took his armies westwards, and from there invaded New Granada, modern Colombia. In other words, he forced the Spaniards to fight him on two fronts, in Venezuela and then in Colombia. Having defeated the Spaniards in Colombia, he then needed to reinforce those victories by dealing with the royalist army that was still strong in the south, in Ecuador and in Peru.
John Lynch, I'm struck by, I think, how little many Americans really know and understand, and I mean North Americans, I mean U.S. citizens, of South America's kind of circumstances and history at that time. If I could just ask some very simple questions. The American Revolution, U.S. Revolution, was over by this time. What was the Spanish presence in South America, and was it comparable to what the British imperial presence had been in North America, in what is now the United States, or different, and how?
It was a military presence as well as a political and administrative presence. And during the War of Independence, in fact, during Bolivar's first campaigns, Spain sent one of the largest military expeditions ever to go to the Americas to counterattack. And the expedition under the Morillo, a veteran of the Peninsular War, was based in Caracas, struck through Colombia, and was powerful enough to resist Bolivar for many years. The Royal Army was also powerful in Peru, not to speak of the rest of South America. So, yes, Spain had military force, but above all, its rule in South America had been based on a habit of obedience and of strong bureaucracy and respect for law and order rather than pure militarism.
Now, the Bolivar's revolution began in 1810, really went on until 1824, 25. That's a long time. You've begun to describe that campaign to us. Who fought with and for him? If you looked at Bolivar's army or armies, were they similar to the armies that were mustered against the British in North America?
Well, Bolivar's armies were composed of many social groups and many ethnic groups. In Venezuela, he recruited from mulattoes and to a certain extent from slaves too. And in fact, he said notoriously, slaves also have the duty to fight for their liberty. And he granted them liberty if they would enroll in his army. In the rest of Venezuela, he recruited from the llaneros, the inhabitants of the Great Plains of Venezuela, who were, in fact, his cavalry forces. And in Peru, he recruited from various sectors of the population, partly through persuasion and partly through economic incentives. So, yes, he had military backing and eventually enough military backing to defeat the Spaniards in open battles.
Now, we know, we of course, in this country, I know the George Washington story, the Virginia planter family, the young surveyor in the what was then the American West, and then on to a military career as general, first president. What about Bolivar's family social background? Where did he emerge from?
Well, he came from, in Venezuelan terms, in South American terms, an aristocratic background. His family were long established in Venezuela and owned estates in the countryside, producing goods for export. His family also owned houses, townhouses in Caracas, and numerous slaves. So yes, he came from an affluent family, not the richest family in Venezuela, but among the richest.
He was orphaned early on. He spent plenty of time in Europe. He saw the aftermath of the French Revolution and imbibed the Enlightenment thinking closely. You describe almost a conversion experience or in Rome where he was overwhelmed with the sense of mission to liberate South America. Can you take us to that moment?
Yes, well, he'd been left bereft by the tragic death of his young wife, and he returned to Europe to, in a sense, overcome his grief and also to acquire further education. And he was self-educated in the sense of he didn't go to university. He read, however, in the classics and in the thought of the Enlightenment. And in educating himself in Europe, he made a trip to Italy and to Rome, and there swore to liberate his country from, as he described it, the slavery of Spanish rule. And he reached that point through reading the in the thought of the Enlightenment, in Montesquieu, Rousseau, and the great thinkers of the time, and also in watching the European political situation, namely the power of France and the decline of the Spanish Bourbons to the point where Spain virtually took over, France virtually took over Spain. And at the same time, he observed the power of Great Britain, whose victory at Trafalgar placed the British Navy in a position of being able to resist any counter-revolutionary force from Europe.
Was the United States Revolution years earlier an inspiration to him, a model, or not?
He respected the United States Revolution and saw it as establishing a home for liberty and equality, and he admired it. His visit to the United States was brief, but nevertheless he saw there liberty in action, and he respected it. He had some reservations towards the United States, mainly because of its proximity as a powerful neighbor, but he didn't make a great deal of that. And it's difficult to justify Chavez's claim that he's a Bolivarian in that sense. Bolivar was certainly not anti-American. And indeed, towards the greatest imperial power of the time, Great Britain, Bolivar was positively deferential. And said that if we ally ourselves with that mistress of the universe, our happiness will be complete. Mm. And it made sense for him to do so, to ally himself with a powerful and a liberal neighbor against the Spain and the Holy Alliance. And he recruited troops from Europe, and he looked for British from England, and he looked for British investments. So he was no anti-American.
I was struck throughout your biography by the complex social structure and the racial structure in South America that Bolivar navigated. The United States had a large slave population, but sort of deferred that as an issue until it exploded in the Civil War and for decades after. He was navigating this at the very time of the revolution. You write that basically South American Indians were losers from independence, and that there was a lot of ambivalence about the revolution itself. beyond, as I read you, almost beyond everything but the Creole class, that is, the descendants of Spaniards born in South America, a real ambivalence about what he was brewing. Why?
Yes, well, towards the Indians, he expressed benevolent sentiments, but some of his policies were mistaken because he decreed that their communal land should be distributed as private property among Indian families. And in the process, of course, they were incapable of adapting to individual ownership, and they lost those lands to their more powerful neighbors. So his Indian policies were benevolent, but not particularly skillful. Towards the slaves, he had a good record. He freed his own slaves, and he decreed the abolition of slavery where he could, and indeed in the Bolivian constitution, he legislated for the total abolition of slavery. He couldn't get that applied in practice because the slave owners, the plantation owners, were powerful enough to resist it. And there you put your finger on the point that his basic support for the Creole class was part of the problem. He saw it as necessary. He wasn't going to overturn the whole social structure of Venezuela and Colombia in a few years, and perhaps lead the Creole class, the propertied class, the landed class, more disposed to revert to Spain than to support his revolution. So he had to tread carefully with the Creoles, and he decided that they were his allies. And that, of course, is another point in which there's no grounds for Chavez claiming to be an heir of Bolivar, because Bolivar was not a social revolutionary, and he never claimed to be one. He was a reformist. That's why he's been criticized by Marx and by the Marxists in South America as leading simply a bourgeois revolution, not a real social revolution. Whereas Chavez has declared himself to be a revolutionary Bolivarian, something that Bolivar himself never claimed to be. He was a reformist, and his reforms were necessary and progressive, but they weren't an overthrow of the existing social structure.
But an overthrow of Spanish rule, the great liberator seen there. John Lynch in London, please stand by. We have listeners who want to join us, and I want to begin to turn to them. Nick is calling from Boston. Hi, Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question for Mr. Lynch. I was wondering, we compare Bolivar to Washington, but I don't hear anything about anybody who would be equivalent to, like, James Madison or John Adams. Did these people exist, or are they just not publicized, or was Bolivar flying alone?
Nick, thanks very much. John Lynch, what about it? What was there the same kind of solar system of figures around Simón Bolivar that we look back on in U.S. history?
Yes, well, Bolivar was surrounded by the Bolivarians. He had his, in a sense, his party, people who respected his intellectual qualities, his military leadership, and his accomplishments. And there were also legislators in Venezuela and Colombia who devised the constitutions and the laws. There was also a flourishing legal class in Colombia in particular. And none of these associates and collaborators of Bolivar, none of the leading participants in the independence movements acquired the status of the North American founding fathers. The exception would be Miranda, of course, who the precursor, but he wasn't successful when he returned to Venezuela and didn't emerge as a great figure there.
This is the man who preceded Bolivar in pushing for independence and was, as I read you,
right,
scorned by Bolivar ultimately.
Indeed, yes.
Was it his personality that drove away a wider circle of founding fathers? I mean, you describe him as a very glory-oriented liberator.
To some extent, he had his reservations about him, the other contemporary leaders in Venezuela and Colombia. But the fact remains that there was no one of his genius. There was no comparable figure. And that, of course, is one of the explanations for the cult of Bolivar. That he was the only one, and one of the cultists explained that take away Bolivar and we've got no others. So there wasn't a great array of founding fathers such as you had in the United States. Bolivar was unique, and there weren't too many Bolivarians around. So apart from Sucre, his protege, and the man he...
Great general.
General Sucre, and the man whom he cultivated to succeed him, there were no other great Bolivarians. There were good soldiers, competent legislators, but nothing to compared to the North American founding fathers.
Let me take a call from Wilmington, New York. Ihor is on the line. Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, it's interesting that you mention his popularity in the United States. Some 15 years ago, I found a 19th century recipe for cookies called Bolivars. It's a molasses buttermilk cookie, very rich and gooey.
Do you think it would taste like Independence?
I don't know. I bake it in the winter. It's a challenging cookie.
Thanks for your call, John Lynch. Did he have a global reputation at the time in the 19th century beyond South America? Was he seen as a towering figure?
Yes, he was known in Europe, and he was certainly known in Spain, of course, but he was known in Great Britain and respected there. And there is an interesting obituary of Bolivar in the Times of London in 1830, written sometime after his death, which said that Bolivar was presented with very poor material on which to work to build states. But whatever could be done to improve the fate of Venezuela, Colombia, and Peru, Bolivar did it, and there was no one else who could have done it.
Sherman's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Sherman, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a question for Professor Lynch. I was a professor at the Simón Bolívar University in Caracas for a number of years, and of course I'm kind of soaked in the tradition of Bolívar. There are two figures in the struggle that I think you might want to mention. One is José Tomás Boves, who is a little bit more like Chávez than Chávez is like Bolívar, I think. He led a royalist slave rebellion and was very much a populist. And the other, on the other side of the struggle, Bolívar's ally was José Antonio Páez. And both of them led lancers that were extremely effective at the time against opposing forces, whichever side you happen to be on. And it so happened that Boves died at a certain point. But I was wondering if you'd like to comment on those two figures.
John Lynch, fill out the picture for us with Boves and Páez, if you would.
Yes, well, Boves was the populist leader, Caudillo, who cultivated the people of the Llanos, the Llaneros, and decided to throw in his lot with the royalists rather than the republicans. So he was, from very early on, an enemy of Bolívar, who recruited his followers on racial grounds among the blacks and the slaves, and he offered them land in return for their service.
Now, Bolivar was an abolitionist, so how would his enemy recruit slaves to fight against him?
Well, that's one of the ironies of the case. Bolivar identified Boves as a dangerous enemy because he was stirring up a race war. And Bolivar thought that to do that would be to revert to colonialism. The Spaniards would certainly accept Boves's alliance, but in the event, change nothing. And he therefore pursued Boves militarily, and eventually his allies, not Bolivar himself, but his allies in the Llanos, Venezuela, caught up with Boves and killed him, and killed off the danger of black revolution. The example of Haiti was always present in the minds of the Venezuelan leaders of independence, and they had no desire to go down that road.
And Jose Antonio Paez?
Paez, on the other hand, Paez, on the other hand, was the Llanos too. He was a leader, but he came from a background of small, petty, white officialdom in the Spanish colonial empire. His father was a colonial official, and Paez decided, as a matter of conviction, to join the revolution for independence, and he became a Republican officer. He, too, had great influence among the Llaneros, among the Lancers of the plains, and he managed to mobilize them into a powerful army that fought the Spaniards in a kind of irregular warfare. The problem was, would he join the Bolivarian alliance and bring his forces? He did so, though with reservations, and while Bolivar accepted his allegiance and his army, he also had to recognize that Paez wouldn't follow him into Colombia, much less into Peru or any of his other expeditions, and stayed behind in Venezuela.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sherman, you were referring there to contemporary resonance of these two, that we might have some resonance in Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. How do you see that?
The way I see it is... Boves was a true populist. He was he would go out and dance with the slave women. He was just he was extremely charismatic. He would
in the Chavez style.
In the Chavez style, exactly. So the parallel that I see between Boves and Chavez is that Chavez is now, since Venezuela is racially mixed so heavily, he is stirring up not racism so much, but classism, whereas Boves, you know, stirred up on racial grounds, which were at the time still very patent. But today, you see a very strong parallel between Boves' style and Chavez' style in stirring up, respectively, racism and classism.
Sherman, thanks very much for your call. Steve's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hello there. Hello there. I have two related questions. First, did Bolivar use tactics for liberation that the Spanish called terrorist or something metaphorically terrorist?
Mm-hmm.
Or did he use tactics that we now consider to be terroristic in nature, and for that matter, to George Washington? But I'm sure he wants to talk about Bolivar.
Yes. Let us look at it. John Lynch, Simon Bolivar declared his war to the death, and the tactics were extreme.
Yes, Bolivar did declare war to the death against Spaniards and Canarians. It wasn't enough to simply remain neutral or stay at home. If you didn't positively join the Republican forces fighting for independence, then you would be exterminated. That was his decree. And to some extent, it was followed out. The justification for it in this cruel colonial war was those were the tactics of the Spaniards already, that they were fighting a war to the death, and if we don't reply, we'll never win this war.
Were his tactics Moreover, such that might be called terrorism today? Or do you ever look at it that way?
No, I wouldn't say it was terrorism, because it was war to the death in open battle. He fought the Spaniards and their allies in open battle, and he didn't take prisoners if they refused to turn round. That's true.
I recall, I think you describing an order that he gave for 800 prisoners to be killed in prison. That doesn't sound too sweet.
Yes, that's true. It's something that defenders of Bolivar have difficulty in explaining. The explanation given by one of the English volunteers in Bolivar's army was that if he didn't do that, if he didn't fight a war to the death, his followers, the Llaneros and the other people who joined his armies, would have no respect for him, and would not accept his leadership. And it was a feature of his leadership. Mm.
Claudia's calling from Austin, Texas. Hi, Claudia, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you all
Very
doing?
Well. Very well.
I have a question, and actually it's more of what is puzzling me, that we keep talking about no other founding fathers in South America. And there was, and somebody that always gets forgotten, the liberator for Argentina, Peru, and Chile, San José de San Martín. Mm. So I was wondering if we can talk a little bit more about him and, you know, his role with Simón Bolívar, because I do know that they worked hand-in-hand together towards this big liberation of South America.
Claudia, let us pick that up. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. John Lynch, you described the six, or what we look at and see as six countries now liberated by Bolivar. Claudia says, let's not forget San Jose San Martin in Argentina. What was the southern sort of border of his influence, and who did he meet with there? How do you see the interplay?
Well, San Martin was the liberator of Argentina, Chile, and he led the spectacular expedition from across the Andes into Chile and from Chile up to Peru, and partly liberated Peru. He failed to completely defeat the Spaniards, certainly in the Sierra. His hold on Peru was only on the coastal areas, and he sought Bolivar's assistance for a combined operation against royalist Peru. Bolivar didn't think he had the army or the capacity to join in such a liberating movement, and so he stood back from San Martin's offer, and there's a certain tension between them. San Martin said, in effect, that there's not room in Peru for Bolivar and me. Mm. And so he left, one of the great examples of a military leader and a victor leaving the field of battle to his rival, to Bolivar. But certainly he was comparable to Bolivar, and in many ways a more likable figure.
Claudia, thanks for your call. John Lynch, you write in a section called A Deal with the Devil. You say, with each year that passed, Bolivar became more conscious of the racial divisions in America and society and the propensity of its people to anarchy. And then you quote him saying, I am convinced to the very marrow of my bones that America can only be ruled by an able despotism. We are the vile offspring of the predatory Spaniards who came to America to bleed her white and to breed with their victims. Describe this angle of Bolivar's thinking and why he was drawn to authoritarianism at the very least after his liberal Enlightenment education.
the quotation is apt, and they're his own words, of course. At the end of his career, despaired of governing the new states. But we ought to remember the chronology of this. First of all, he had overcome the Spanish occupying forces in South America and thrown out the Spaniards. To do that, he'd had to impose absolute rule wherever he could in the cause of military strength. Then came the problem of post-war state building. That's where the trouble began. And there were rival solutions, of course, on offer at the time. The liberals didn't like his authoritarian ways, and the Pardos, that is the mixed races, and the blacks and the ex-slaves didn't always accept his authoritarian ways, and so he thought that this heterogeneous society is going to lead to further trouble, and unless we unless we establish the Creole ruling class as the traditional ruling class of South America, there's no future. Those were his authoritarian positions, and there's no denying it, that at the end of his life, there's a certain disillusion.
It's taken South America a long time to embrace democracy, some countries more successful than others, but many decades of struggle. How much of that do you see as the legacy of Bolivar, and how much do you see as simply a result of the particular history and challenges of the South American melting pot?
The legacy of Bolivar, I think, is mainly positive. After all, he was the hero, the liberator, the man who actually defeated a strong colonial empire and established national independence. It was imperfect in his own eyes, but I think recognized by the rest of the world as a great achievement. What he couldn't do was to change the strong regionalism, the heterogeneous society, the underdeveloped economy, and the post-war weakness. These were factors and conditions that his leadership couldn't be expected to overcome in 20 or so years.
And we've just got a minute here, John Lynch. What, he ended his life in exile. Why?
Well, he was voted out of power, in effect. Not by a democratic vote, but the other legislators in Bogota decided that he had no solution. They refused to accept his great constitution. The Bolivian constitution is too authoritarian. You see, he wanted the president to be elected for life with the power to nominate his successor. Something, incidentally, with which I think Chavez aspires to. The ironical thing is that particular legacy was not popular at the time. The idea of a life president appealed to very few people, and so that was the reason he was driven out of power. Not actually into exile, but he never got as far as exile. He got to the coast of near Cartagena.
But reborn in legacy, even in cult today. John Lynch, it's history that we don't know well enough, and we're very grateful to for your work in the new biography, Simón Bolívar, A Life, and in your time with us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
John Lynch, Professor Emeritus of Latin American History, former Director of the Institute of Latin American Studies at the University of London. The new biography, Simón Bolívar, A Life. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.